Grand bristled with self-confidence, a sense of mission, an esprit de corps. Military uniforms signaled visitors from Washington. Executives from defense firms came for meetings. The consultants, mostly under 30, carried briefcases, smoked pipes, and walked around looking self-important. Big shots like von Neumann and Hermann Kahn had shouting matches in the hallways. There was a feeling around the place of wanting to outrun the enemy, as a former RAND vice president later put it. Arrow, who was an Army veteran from the Bronx, said, "We were all convinced that the mission was important, though there was lots of room for intellectual vision." RAND's sense of mission was propelled largely by a single fact. Russia had the A-bomb. That shocking news had been delivered by President Truman the previous fall, a mere 4 years after Nagasaki and Hiroshima, and many years before Washington had expected it. The military had hard evidence, the president said in a speech on September 13, 1949, of a nuclear explosion deep inside the Soviet Union. Nobody in the scientific community, especially around Princeton, where von Neumann and Oppenheimer were engaged in an almost daily debate over the wisdom of pushing ahead with the super, doubted that the Soviets were capable of developing nuclear weapons. The shock was that they had succeeded so quickly. Physicists and mathematicians who were less convinced of Russia's scientific and technological backwardness had been warning the administration all along that predictions by senior government officials that America's nuclear monopoly would persist another 10, 15, or 20 years were hopelessly naive. But the sense of being caught off guard was still very great. The news effectively ended the debate over the hydrogen bomb more or less immediately. By the time the president delivered the news of the Soviet explosion to the public, he had authorized a crash program at Los Alamos to design and manufacture an H-bomb. It was unthinkable that such destructive power would be unleashed. Therefore, RAND insisted that it was necessary to ponder the possibility. The rational life was worshipped to an almost absurd degree. RAND was full of men and women committed to the idea that systematic thought and quantification were the key to the most complex problems. Facts, preferably detached from emotion, convention, and preconception, reigned supreme. If reducing complex political and military choices, including the problem of nuclear war, to mathematical formulae could produce light, why then the same approach must be good for more mundane matters. RAND scientists tried to tell their wives that the decision whether to buy or not to buy a washing machine was an optimization problem. RAND was privy to the military's most highly guarded secrets at a time when the nation was growing increasingly nervous about the safeguarding of those secrets to the point of paranoia. From the summer of 1950 on, RAND would be increasingly affected by the growing alarm over Russian access to American military secrets. It began with the Fuchs trial in the winter of 1950. Fuchs was a German émigré scientist who had fled to Britain during the war and eventually wound up working with von Neumann and Edward Teller at Los Alamos. A clandestine member of the British Communist Party, Fuchs subsequently confessed in January 1950 to passing atomic secrets to the Russians, and was tried and convicted in London that February. Senator Joseph McCarthy had embarked that same month on his anti-communist campaign, accusing the federal government of security breaches. 4 years later, in April of 1954, Robert Oppenheimer, the former head of the Manhattan Project, the director of the Institute for Advanced Study, and the most famous scientist in America, was declared a security risk by Eisenhower and stripped of his security clearances in the full glare of national publicity. The ostensible reason was Oppenheimer's youthful left-wing associations, but the real reason, as von Neumann and most scientists testified at the time, was Oppenheimer's refusal to support the development of the H-bomb. The fact that McCarthy himself ultimately became a target of censure would do little to dispel the atmosphere of paranoia and intimidation at RAND, which lived on Air Force and AEC money and had projects on the H-bomb and ICBMs. Most of what the mathematicians worked on was not, in fact, classified, but that didn't matter. RAND, which harbored a collection of oddballs like Richard Bellman, a former Princeton mathematician who had all kinds of communist associations, mostly accidental, including a chance encounter with a cousin of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, would become particularly careful about minding its P's and Q's. Everybody needed a top-secret clearance. People who arrived without a temporary security clearance were banished to quarantine or pre-clearance and weren't permitted to sit with everybody else. Nash's secret clearance was granted on October 25, 1950. His recollection that he had a top-secret clearance, which a large contingent of the math division did have, is probably faulty. Nash also recalls that he applied for a Q clearance in 1952. Any consultant to the math division who worked on Atomic Energy Commission contracts was required to have a Q clearance because of access to documents related to the construction and use of nuclear weapons. But despite a November 10, 1952 postcard to his parents telling them that he had applied for a higher clearance at RAND, Nash now says it was never approved, meaning that his role at RAND was largely confined to highly theoretical exercises as opposed to applications of game theory concepts to actual questions of nuclear strategy, the province of men like von Neumann, Hermann Kahn, and Thomas Schelling. Everyone had a safe in his office for storing classified documents, and everyone was warned about taking documents out of the building or talking out of school. Papers had to be put in the safes at the end of every day. There were spot checks. There was a public address system, and there were parts of the building that were off limits to people who didn't have a Q clearance. By 1953, soon after Eisenhower issued a new set of security guidelines, security consciousness, in the sense of not overlooking anyone who might be thought remotely unreliable, grew. The Eisenhower guidelines broadened the grounds for denying a clearance or stripping someone of an existing clearance. Without a doubt, fear about potential leaks brought to a boil many simmering antagonisms against individuals and groups who posed little or no actual threat to security. Almost any sign of nonconformity, political or personal, came to be considered a potential security breach. The notion, for example, that homosexuals were unreliable because of either poor judgment or vulnerability to blackmail was first codified in the Eisenhower guidelines. Like the decade itself, RAND had a split personality. Its style was informal, it tolerated quirky people. It was in some ways more democratic than a university. Almost everyone, including von Neumann, was called by his or her first name, except by the guards, never doctor or professor or sir. Graduate students rubbed shoulders with full professors in a way unimaginable in most academic departments. RAND's president, a former Douglas aircraft executive, was a spit-and-polish man who was almost never seen in a suit and tie. All but one or two of the mathematicians, including Nash, came to work in short-sleeved shirts. Appearances were so casual that one mathematician who found it all very déclassé felt obliged to rebel by wearing a three-piece suit and tie to the office every day. Practical jokes were as much a part of the RAND culture as pipes and crew cuts. Mathematicians and physicists mixed rubber bands into the pipe tobacco, substituted dog biscuits for cookies, and tilted desks so pencils rolled onto the floor. Wit was greatly appreciated. When John Williams, the head of RAND's mathematics department, wrote a primer on game theory, published as a RAND study, it was illustrated with funny little cartoon figures and full of jokey examples, starring John Nash, Alex Mood, Lloyd Shapley, John Milner, and other members of the math department. The mathematicians were, as usual, the freest spirits. They had no set hours. If they wanted to come into their offices at 3 a.m., fine. Shapley, who had come back from Princeton for the summer and continued to insist on the sanctity of his sleep cycle, was rarely seen before mid-afternoon. Another man, an electrical engineer named Hastings, typically slept in the shop next to his beloved computer. Lunches were long, much to the annoyance of RAND's engineers who prided themselves on sticking to a more respectable routine. The mathematicians mostly took their bag lunches to a conference room and pulled out chessboards. They invariably played Kriegsspiel, usually in total silence, occasionally punctuated by a wrathful outburst from Shapley, who frequently lost his temper over an umpire's or opponent's error. Even though the games typically lasted well into the afternoon, they were rarely finished and finally reluctantly abandoned mid-game. Poker and bridge groups met after hours. There were no afternoon teas, formal seminars, or faculty meetings at Rand. Unlike the physicists and engineers, the mathematicians usually worked alone. The idea was that they would work on their own ideas, but would help solve the myriad problems encountered by researchers, picking up problems to solve as the spirit moved them. People would drift into each other's offices, or more frequently simply stop to chat in the corridors near the coffee stations. The grids and courtyards of Rand's permanent headquarters, to which the mathematics group moved in 1953, the year before Nash's final summer at Rand, were designed by John Williams, as it happens, to maximize chance meetings. Through such encounters, new research was announced, and mathematicians got hooked on problems that colleagues in other departments wanted solved. Most of the work wasn't reported formally, and even when it was published as Rand Memoranda, there was no formal approval process. A consultant would simply go to the math department secretaries, hand over a handwritten paper, and a day or two later, a Rand memorandum would appear. Published reports for outside circulation didn't go through a much more rigorous vetting process. This copacetic atmosphere was mostly Williams's doing. Witty and charming, weighing close to 300 pounds, expensively suited, Williams looked like a businessman always about to reach into his pocket to pull out a wad of twenties. An astronomer from Arizona who had spent a couple of years in Princeton attending lectures in Fine Hall, playing poker and developing an enthusiasm for the theory of games, Williams had been a dollar-a-year man in Washington during the war, and became Rand's fifth employee afterward. Williams hated flying. He loved fast cars. At one point he spent an entire year outfitting his chocolate-brown Jaguar with a powerful Cadillac engine. It had taken substantial Rand resources, Rand had a repair shop, and considerable bravado to install the thing. Cadillac and Jaguar mechanics had both dismissed the idea as impractical, but Williams had prevailed. He disproved the mechanics' conventional wisdom in late-night 125-mile-an-hour drives along the Pacific Coast Highway. Williams's approach to management would have made him very much at home in Silicon Valley today. Williams had a theory, recalled his deputy Alexander Mood, also a former Princetonian. He believed people should be left alone. He was a great believer in basic research. He was a very relaxed administrator. That's why people thought the math department was pretty weird. Williams's letter to von Neumann, offering the mathematician a $200-a-month retainer, conveys the man's style. The letter said, "The only part of your thinking we'd like to bid for systematically is that which you spend shaving. We'd like you to pass on to us any ideas that come to you while so engaged." When Williams first arrived, Rand was a tiny annex inside a mammoth Douglas aircraft factory where 30,000 workers punched time cards every day. Williams was the one who freed the mathematicians from the clock and then proceeded to demand coffee and blackboards for his mathematicians, explaining that not providing these would guarantee that none of them would produce anything worthwhile. After Rand and Douglas Aircraft parted company, Williams went further. He insisted that the building be open 24 hours a day instead of just between 8 and 5. He got private offices. He set up coffee stations that had their own special full-time maintenance crew. He mollified the engineers and the Air Force generals who wondered why the hell the mathematicians had to be allowed to be themselves. Everyone soon knew Nash by sight. He roamed the halls incessantly. He was usually chewing an empty paper coffee cup that was clamped firmly between his teeth. He would glide through the corridors for hours at a time, frowning, lost in thought, shirt untucked, his powerfully built shoulders hunched forward, his sharp Nixonian nose leading the way. Sometimes he wore a small ironic smile that suggested some secret amusement not likely to be shared with anyone he might encounter. When he did meet someone he knew, he rarely greeted him by name, or even acknowledged his presence unless spoken to first, and then not always. When he wasn't chewing a coffee cup, he whistled, often the same tune from Bach's The Art of the Fugue, over and over again. His legend had preceded him. In the eyes of his new colleagues, Arrow recalled, Nash was A young genius who could do anything, a guy who liked solving problems. Mathematicians who were struggling with tricky problems quickly learned to collar him by planting themselves squarely in his path. Nash's curiosity was easily piqued, they discovered, provided that the problem struck him as interesting and the speaker mathematically competent. He was usually more than willing to step around to their offices to look at masses of messy equations on their blackboards. Williams's deputy, Alex Mood, was one of the first to try. A gentle giant of a man with a dry wit and easy manner, Mood happened to be oppressed by a problem left over from a first ill-fated thesis attempt at Princeton before the war. He had found a better derivation of a famous solution, he felt, but his proof was overly long, too complicated, and distressingly inelegant. Could Nash come up with something shorter, simpler? Nash listened and stared, frowned, and walked away. But the very next day he was back at Mood's door with a clever and entirely unanticipated solution. Nash had sidestepped the whole induction by regarding integers as variables and sending them to revealing limits. As much as anything else, Mood was charmed by Nash's style. When he found a problem, Mood recalled, he sat down and started attacking it immediately. He didn't, like some of his colleagues, browse through the library to see what related stuff had already been done. Williams, too, was immediately taken with Nash and took him under his wing. He frequently told others that Nash had greater insight into mathematical structure than any mathematician he had ever known. An extraordinary remark from a man who spent the late 1930s in Fine Hall and was an intimate of von Neumann's. He knew which factors of 100,000 were the most important, Williams used to say. He liked to describe how Nash would come into an office, stare at a blackboard dense with equations, and stand there, silently meditating. Then, Williams would say, he'd solve the whole thing. He could see the structure. However, Nash mostly kept to himself. He talked about his own research rarely, and then only with a select few. When he did, it was not usually because he was looking for help. It wasn't so much that he sought advice, another consultant recalled. You were a reflecting mirror. He was his own creative object. The only person he regularly sought out at Rand was Shapley, and fairly soon people around the mathematics division started to think of the two as a pair, Rand's Wunderkinder. Still, Nash's eccentricity soon became fodder for Rand's gossip mill. He reinforced Rand's idea that mathematicians were a bit crazy, Mood said. His office, in which he could rarely be found, was a god-awful mess. When he left at the end of that summer, he did so without bothering to clean out his desk. The staffer who was saddled with the chore found, among other things, banana peels, bank statements for Swiss bank accounts with thousands of dollars in them, $100 or $200 in cash, classified documents, the C1 isometric embedding paper. Some people found Nash absurdly childish. He was fond of playing adolescent jokes on his colleagues. Knowing that his whistling irritated one particular music-loving mathematician who frequently asked him to stop, he once left behind a recording of his whistling on the man's dictaphone. Rand's blue-collar police force and maintenance crew found Nash an entertaining subject. They would watch him as he left the building walking north on Fourth Avenue. On several occasions, some of them complained to a Rand manager that they had seen Nash tiptoeing exaggeratedly along the avenue, stalking flocks of pigeons, and then suddenly rushing forward, trying to kick them. Chapter 13. Game Theory at Rand. We hope the theory of games will work, just as we hoped in 1942 that the atomic bomb would work. Anonymous Pentagon Scientist to Fortune, 1949. Nash's novel idea about games with many players had preceded him at Rand by several months. The first version of his elegant proof of the existence of equilibrium for games with many players, two skimpy pages in the November 1949 issue of the National Academy of Sciences Proceedings, swept through the white stucco building at 4th and Broadway like a California brush fire. The biggest appeal of the Nash equilibrium concept was its promise of liberation from the two-person zero-sum game. The mathematicians, military strategists, and economists at Rand had focused almost exclusively on games of total conflict, My win is your loss or vice versa between two players. Shapley and Drescher's 1949 review of game theory research at RAND refers to the organization's preoccupation with the zero-sum two-person game. That preoccupation was natural, given that these were games for which the von Neumann theory was both sound and reasonably complete. Zero-sum games also seemed to fit the problem, nuclear conflict between two superpowers, which absorbed most of RAND's attention. Only it really didn't. At least some of the researchers at RAND were already chafing at the central assumption of a fixed payoff in such games, Arrow recalled. As weapons got ever more destructive, even all-out war had ceased to be a situation of pure conflict, in which opponents had no common interest whatever. Inflicting the greatest amount of damage on an enemy, bombing him back to the Stone Age, no longer made any sense, as American strategists realized during the final phase of the campaign against Germany, when they decided not to destroy the coal mines and industrial complexes of the Ruhr. As Thomas C. Schelling, one of RAND's nuclear strategists, would put it a decade later, "In international affairs, there is mutual dependence as well as opposition. Pure conflict in which the interests of two antagonists are completely opposed is a special case. It would arise in a war of complete extermination. Otherwise, not even in war. The possibility of mutual accommodation is as important and dramatic as the element of conflict. Concepts like deterrence, limited war, and disarmament, as well as negotiation, are concerned with the common interest and mutual dependence that can exist between participants in a conflict." Schelling goes on to say why this is so. "These are games in which, though the element of conflict provides the dramatic interest, mutual dependence is part of the logical structure, and demands some kind of collaboration, or mutual accommodation, tacit if not explicit, even if only in the avoidance of mutual disaster." In 1950, at least the economists at RAND were aware that if game theory were to evolve into a descriptive theory that could be usefully applied to real-life military and economic conflicts, one had to focus on games that allowed for cooperation as well as conflict. Everybody was already bothered by the zero-sum game, Arrow recalled. "You're trying to decide whether to go to war or not. You couldn't say that the losses to the losers were gains to the winner. It was a troublesome thing." Military strategists were the first to seize on the ideas of game theory. Most economists ignored the theory of games and economic behavior, and the few that didn't, like John Kenneth Galbraith, writing in Fortune, and Carl Kaysen, later director of the Institute for Advanced Study, turn out to have had significant contact with military strategists during the war. An article in Fortune in 1949 by John MacDonald made it clear that the military hoped to use von Neumann's theory of games to work out intelligence missions, bombing patterns, and nuclear defense strategy. On the outlook for new ideas and with plenty of money to spend, the Air Force embraced game theory with the same enthusiasm with which the Prussian military had embraced probability theory a couple hundred years earlier. Game theory had already made its debut in military planning rooms. It had been used during the war to develop anti-submarine tactics when German submarines were destroying American military transports. As MacDonald reported in Fortune, "The military application of games was begun early in the last war, sometime, in fact, before the publication of the complete theory by ASWOEG, Anti-Submarine Warfare Operations Evaluation Group. Mathematicians in the group had got hold of von Neumann's first paper on poker, published in 1928. But von Neumann actually spent his frenetic visits to Santa Monica almost exclusively with the computer engineers and the nuclear scientists. His enormous prestige and Williams's deft salesmanship led to a major concentration on game theory at RAND from 1947 into the 1950s. The hope was that game theory would prove the mathematical underpinning for a theory of human conflict and spread to disciplines other than mathematics. Williams convinced the Air Force to let RAND create two new divisions, economics and social science, By the time Nash arrived, a trust of game theory research had grown up at Rand, including such game theorists as Lloyd S. Shapley, J.C. McKenzie, N. Dahlke, F.B. Thompson, and H.F. Bonenbloost. Such pure mathematicians as John Milner, statisticians David Blackwell, Sam Carlin, and Abraham Gershik, and economists Paul Samuelson, Kenneth Arrow, and Herbert Simon. Most of the Rand military applications of game theory concerned tactics. Air battles between fighters and bombers were modeled as duels. The strategic problem in a duel is one of timing. For each opponent, having the first shot maximizes the chance of a miss, but having the better shot also maximizes the chance for being hit. The question is when to fire. There's a trade-off. By waiting a little longer, each opponent improves his own chance of scoring a hit, but also increases the risk of being shot down. Such duels can be both noisy and silent. With silent guns, the duelist doesn't know the other has fired unless he is hit. Therefore, neither participant knows whether the other still has a bullet, or has fired and missed, and is now defenseless. A report by Drescher and Shapley summarizing Rand's game theory research between the fall of 1947 and the spring of 1949 gives the flavor. The mathematicians describe a problem of staggered attacks in a bombing mission. Problem: a single interceptor base, having I fighters, is located on a baseline. Each fighter has a given endurance. If a fighter, vectored out against a bomber attack, has not yet engaged his original target, then at the option of the ground controller, he may be vectored back to engage a second attack. The attacker has a stock of N bombers and A bombs. The attacker chooses 2 points to attack and sends N1 bombers, including A1 bomb carriers, on the first attack, and T minutes later he sends N2 equals N minus N1 bombers, including A2 equals A minus A1 carriers, on the second attack. The payoff to the attacker is the number of bomb carriers that are not destroyed by the fighters. Solution: both players have pure optimal strategies. An optimal strategy of the attacker is to attack both targets simultaneously and distribute the A-bomb carriers in proportion to the number of bombers in each attack. An optimum strategy for the defender is to dispatch interceptors in proportion to the number of attacking bombers, and not to re-vector fighters. The value of the game to the attacker will be V equals the maximum of the two quantities 0 and A times the quantity 1 minus 1 divided by N times K, where K is the kill probability of the fighter. The game Nash had in mind could be solved without communication or collaboration. Von Neumann had long believed that the Rand researchers ought to focus on cooperative games, conflicts in which players have the opportunity to communicate and collaborate and are able to discuss the situation and agree on a rational joint plan of action, an agreement that is assumed to be enforceable. In cooperative games, players form coalitions and reach agreements. The key assumption is that there is an umpire around to enforce the agreement. The mathematics of cooperative games, like the mathematics of zero-sum games, is rich and elegant. But most economists, like Arrow, were cool to the idea. It was like saying, they thought, that the only hope for preventing a dangerous and wasteful nuclear arms race lay in appointing a world government with the power to enforce simultaneous disarmament. World government, as it happens, was a popular idea among mathematicians and scientists at the time. Albert Einstein, Bertrand Russell, and indeed much of the world's intellectual elite subscribed to some version of one-worldism. Even von Neumann tipped his hat to the notion, conservative hawk that he was. But most social scientists were dubious that any nation, much less the Soviets, would cede sovereignty to such an extent. Cooperative game theory also seemed to have little relevance to most economic, political, and military problems. As Arrow jokingly put it, "You did have cooperative game theory, but I couldn't force the other side to cooperate." By demonstrating that non-cooperative games, games that did not involve joint actions, had stable solutions, said Arrow, Nash suddenly provided a framework to ask the right questions. At Rand, he added, it immediately led a lot of people to calculate equilibrium points. News of Nash's equilibrium result also inspired the most famous game of strategy in all of social science, the Prisoner's Dilemma. The Prisoner's Dilemma was partly invented at Rand some months before Nash arrived by two Rand mathematicians who responded to Nash's idea with more skepticism than appreciation of the revolution that Nash's concept of a game would inspire. The actual tale of prisoners used to illustrate the game's significance was invented by Nash's Princeton mentor, Al Tucker, who used it to explain what game theory was all about to an audience of psychologists at Stanford. As Tucker told the story, the police arrest two suspects and question them in separate rooms. Each one is given the choice of confessing, implicating the other, or keeping silent. The central feature of the game is that no matter what the other suspect does, each, considered alone, would be better off if he confessed. If the other confesses, the suspect in question ought to do the same and thereby avoid an especially harsh penalty for holding out. If the other remains silent, he can get especially lenient treatment for turning state's witness. Confession is the dominant strategy. The irony is that both prisoners, considered together, would be better off if neither confessed, that is, if they cooperated. But since each is aware of the other's incentive to confess, it is rational for both to confess. Since 1950, the Prisoner's Dilemma has spawned an enormous psychology literature on determinants of cooperation and defection. On a conceptual level, the game highlights the fact that Nash equilibria, defined as each player is following his best strategy, assuming that the other players will follow their best strategy, aren't necessarily the best solution from the vantage point of the group of players. Thus, the Prisoner's Dilemma contradicts Adam Smith's metaphor of the invisible hand in economics. When each person in the game pursues his private interest, he does not necessarily promote the best interest of the collective. The arms race between the Soviet Union and the United States could be thought of as a prisoner's dilemma. Both nations might be better off if they cooperated and avoided the race, yet the dominant strategy is for each to arm itself to the teeth. However, it doesn't appear that Drescher and Flood, Tucker, or for that matter von Neumann, thought of the prisoner's dilemma in the context of superpower rivalry. For them, the game was simply an interesting challenge to Nash's idea. The very afternoon that Drescher and Flood learned of Nash's equilibrium idea, they ran an experiment using Williams and a UCLA economist, Armin Alkian, as guinea pigs. Poundstone says that Flood and Drescher wondered if real people playing the game, especially people who had never heard of Nash or equilibrium points, would be drawn mysteriously to the equilibrium strategy. Flood and Drescher doubted it. The mathematicians ran their experiment 100 times. Nash's theory predicted that both players would play their dominant strategies, even though playing their dominated strategies would have left both better off. Though Williams and Alkian didn't always cooperate, the results hardly resembled a Nash equilibrium. Drescher and Flood argued, and von Neumann apparently agreed, that their experiment showed that players tended not to choose Nash equilibrium strategies, and instead were likely to split the difference. As it turns out, Williams and Alkian chose to cooperate more often than they chose to cheat. Comments recorded after each player decided on strategy but before he learned the other player's strategy show that Williams realized that players ought to cooperate to maximize their winnings. When Alkian didn't cooperate, Williams punished him, then went back to cooperating next round. Nash, who learned of the experiment from Tucker, sent Drescher and Flood a note, later published as a footnote in their report, disagreeing with their interpretation. The flaw in the experiment as a test of equilibrium point theory is that the experiment really amounts to having the players play one large multi-move game. One cannot just as well think of the thing as a sequence of independent games as one can in zero-sum cases. There is too much interaction. It is really striking, however, how inefficient Player 1 and Player 2 were in obtaining the rewards. One would have thought them more rational. Nash managed to solve a problem at Rand that he and Shapley had both been working on the previous year. The problem was to devise a model of negotiation between two parties, whose interests neither coincided nor were diametrically opposed, that the players could use to determine what threats they should use in the process of negotiating. Nash beat Shapley to the punch. "We all worked on this problem," Martin Shubik later wrote in a memoir of his Princeton experiences, "but Nash managed to formulate a good model of the two-person bargain utilizing threat moves to start with." Instead of deriving the solution axiomatically, that is, listing desirable properties of a reasonable solution and then proving that these properties actually point to a unique outcome, as he had in formulating his original model of bargaining, Nash laid out a four-step negotiation. Stage 1. Each player chooses a threat. "This is what I'll be forced to do if we can't make a deal, that is, if our demands are incompatible." Stage 2. The players inform each other of the threats. Stage 3. Each player chooses a demand, that is, an outcome worth a certain amount to him. If the bargain doesn't guarantee him that amount, he won't agree to a deal. Stage 4. If it turns out that a deal exists that satisfies both players' demands, the players get what they ask for. Otherwise, the threats have to be executed. It turns out that the game has an infinite number of Nash equilibria, but Nash gave an ingenious argument for selecting a unique stable equilibrium that coincides with the bargaining solution he previously derived axiomatically. He showed that each player had an optimal threat, that is, a threat that ensures that a deal is struck, no matter what strategy the other player chooses. Nash initially wrote up his results in a Rand memorandum dated August 31, 1950, suggesting that he managed to finish the paper just before leaving Rand for Bluefield. A longer and more descriptive version of the paper was eventually accepted by Econometrica, which had published The Bargaining Problem that April. Accepted for publication sometime during the following academic year, Two-Person Cooperative Games did not in fact appear until January 1953. It was Nash's last significant contribution to the theory of games. Nobody at Rand solved any big new problems in the theory of non-cooperative games. For all intents and purposes, Nash stopped working in the field in 1950. The dominant thrust of game theory at Rand came from the mathematicians, particularly Shapley, and they were guided less by applications than by the mathematics themselves. During the 1950s, Shapley focused on cooperative games, which were necessarily of limited interest, not only to economists, but also to military strategists. The justification of all mathematical models is that, oversimplified, unrealistic, and even false as they may be in some respect, they force analysts to confront possibilities that would not have occurred to them otherwise. The history of physics and medicine abounds with wrong or incomplete theories that throw just enough light to allow some other big breakthroughs. The atom bomb, for example, was built before physicists understood the structure of particles. The most significant application of game theory to a military problem grew straight out of the theory of duels and helped shape what was probably Rand's single most influential strategic study. The study was the brainchild of Al Wallstetter, a mathematician who joined Rand's economics group in early 1951, about 6 months after Nash joined the mathematics group. According to Kaplan, the SAC operational plan in the early 1950s was to fly bombers from the United States to overseas bases and then to mobilize and launch an attack against the Soviet Union from there. The Air Force's whole deterrence strategy was based on the idea of the power of the H-bomb and America's ability to respond in kind to any attack. Apparently, no one before Wallstetter had focused on vulnerability to a first strike aimed not at American cities, but at wiping out the SAC force, then concentrated on a small number of foreign bases within striking distance of the Soviet Union. Kaplan writes, "Up to that point, most military applications of game theory had focused on tactics, the best way to plan a fighter-bomber duel, how to design bomber formations or execute anti-submarine warfare campaigns. But Wallstetter would carry it further. It was this insistence on figuring out one's own best moves in light of the enemy's best moves that provoked Wallstetter to look at a map, and to conclude that the closer we are to them, the closer they are to us. The easier it is for us to hit them, the easier it is for them to hit us. Wallstetter and his team estimated that a mere 120 bombs could destroy 75% to 85% of the B-47 bombers while they casually sat on overseas bases. The SAC, seemingly the most powerful strike force in the world, was appearing to be so vulnerable in so many ways that merely putting the plan into action created a target so concentrated that it invited a preemptive attack from the Soviet Union. Wallstetter's study had an electrifying effect on the Air Force establishment. With its focus on American vulnerability and the temptation of a Soviet surprise attack, the study also rationalized a paranoia in the military establishment that seeped into the body politic and wound up as national hysteria over the supposed missile gap in the second half of the 1950s. The RAND report, Fred Kaplan writes, legitimized a basic fear of the enemy and the unknown through mathematical calculation and rational analysis, providing the techniques and the general perspective through which the new and rather scary situation, the Soviet Union's acquisition of long-range nuclear weapons, could be discussed and acted upon. The Golden Age at RAND, from the point of view of the mathematicians, strategic thinkers, and economists, was already coming to a close. After a time, RAND's sponsors grew less enthusiastic about pure research, less tolerant of idiosyncrasies, and more demanding. Mathematicians got bored and frustrated with game theory. Consultants stopped coming, and permanent staffers drifted to universities. Nash never returned after the summer of 1954. Flood left for Columbia University in 1953. Von Neumann, who in any case had played a very small role in the group after inspiring it, dropped his RAND consultancy in 1954 when he accepted an appointment as a member of the Atomic Energy Commission. Game theory, in any case, was going out of vogue at RAND. R. Duncan Luce and Howard Rafa concluded in their 1957 book, Games and Decisions, "We have the historical fact that many social scientists have become disillusioned with game theory. Initially, there was a naive bandwagon feeling that game theory solved innumerable problems of sociology and economics, or that at least it made their solution a practical matter of a few years' work. This has not turned out to be the case." The military strategists were of the same mind. "Whenever we speak of deterrence, atomic blackmail, the balance of terror, we are evidently deep in game theory," Thomas Schelling wrote in 1960. Yet formal game theory has contributed little to the clarification of these ideas. Chapter 14, The Draft, Princeton, 1950-51. Neither the prospect of playing military strategist, nor living in Santa Monica, nor earning a handsome salary, tempted Nash to accept Williams's offer of a permanent post at the think tank. Nash shared little of RAND's camaraderie or sense of mission. He wanted to work on his own and to have the freedom to roam all over mathematics. To do that, he would have to obtain a faculty position at a leading university. For the moment, he planned to spend the upcoming academic year in Princeton. Tucker had arranged for his support by assigning him to teach a section of undergraduate calculus and making him a research assistant on his Office of Naval Research grant. In fact, Nash intended to devote most of his energy to his own research and to looking for an academic opening for the following fall. But before he could turn to these matters, he was forced to confront an immediate threat to his career plans, namely the Korean War. North Korea had invaded the South on June 25, 1950, about the time that Nash was flying to Santa Monica. A week later, Truman promised to send American troops to repel the invasion. The first reinforcements landed July 19th. By July 31st, Truman had issued an order to the Selective Service to call up 100,000 young men right away, 20,000 immediately. A week or two later, John Senior and Virginia wrote that Nash might be in imminent danger of being drafted. Like most Republicans, they disliked Truman and had their doubts about the war. They urged Nash to come to Bluefield as soon as practical to talk with members of the local draft board personally, to sound them out about a 2A. Surely, they said, Nash was more valuable at RAND or at Princeton than in uniform. When Nash left Rand at the very end of August, he flew from Los Angeles to Boston and spent a day at the World Mathematical Congress, which was meeting in Cambridge. He presented his algebraic manifolds result to a small audience there, a nice distinction for a young mathematician, but he was anxious to get back to Bluefield and didn't stay for most of the meetings. He was determined to do all he could to avoid the draft. With a war on, even an unpopular and undeclared war, who knew how long he would have to serve? Any interruption of his research would jeopardize his dream of joining a top-ranked mathematics department. Returning World War II veterans had flooded the job market and enrollments were falling because of the draft. In 2 years, there would be another crop of brilliant youngsters clamoring for the handful of instructorships. His game theory thesis had been greeted with a mix of indifference and derision by the pure mathematicians, so his only hope of a good offer, he felt, was to finish his paper on algebraic manifolds. Besides, he had no wish to become part of someone else's larger design, and dreaded the thought of military life, his hawkish instincts and southern background notwithstanding. He'd been one of the few boys at Beaver High who hadn't prayed for World War II to last long enough so that he would have a chance to serve. Life in the Army, with its mindless regimentation, stultifying routines, and lack of privacy, revolted him. And he had heard enough stories from other mathematicians to dread being herded together with the kind of rude, uneducated young men whose company he had been only too happy to escape when he left Bluefield for Carnegie Tech. Nash proceeded methodically. Once back in Bluefield, he called on two members of the board, including its chairman, a retired attorney named T.H. Scott, whom he later described as a rock-ribbed Republican, Truman equals moron equals Roosevelt, and a Dr. H.L. Dickison, the president of Bluefield State, a black junior college on the far side of the town. He made it his business to find out as much as he could about the men who would be deciding his fate. As it turned out, the board had only a fuzzy sense of what Nash was doing. Until he showed up at the Peary Building, they had no idea that he had already received his doctorate and had assumed he was returning to Princeton that fall as a student. His student deferment had not yet been canceled. His meeting with Scott did nothing to ease his anxiety. The board was already working through its list of 22-year-olds. Now that the board knew that he was no longer a graduate student, he might very well be in the next call, which was scheduled for the 20th of the month, less than 2 weeks away. Nash mentioned that he was doing classified research for the military and described both his affiliation with Rand and the ONR project at Princeton. Scott did not rule out the possibility of granting an occupational deferment, but he expressed some skepticism that a young mathematician could be indispensable except in uniform in a national emergency. Nash felt slightly better about his meeting with Dickison, who had taught math and physics before the war, and appeared to be impressed by Nash's Princeton degree and associates. It was probably Dickison who tipped Nash off to the fact that merely filing an application for a 2A, an occupational deferment, would temporarily halt the wheels of the draft machinery and take him out of the pool of potential draftees, at least until the board had time to consider his 2A application. Nash wasted no time. In Bluefield, he went to the library and read the Selective Service Law. He thought about the board's psychology. He wrote to Tucker, to the Office of Naval Research in Washington, and no doubt also to Williams at Rand, though there is no record of such a letter. A letter from the Office of Naval Research in Washington received by Al Tucker on September 15th begins, "John Nash has written me asking if ONR can help get him a draft deferment." Nash asked them to request a 2A deferment, but urged them to state only the bare facts, promising more information later, so that heavier guns may be later rolled out without the appearance of merely repeating the initial statements. He was intent on buying as much time as possible. Later on, in other circumstances, Nash would repeatedly express his dislike and resentment of politics and politicking. But impractical, childish, and detached from everyday concerns as he was in some ways, he was quite capable of plotting strategy, ferreting out necessary facts, making use of his father's connections, and most of all, marshaling allies and supporters. Tucker, the university, the Navy, and Rand responded sympathetically and promptly, claiming in unison that he was irreplaceable, it would take years to train a substitute, and his work was essential to the welfare and security of this nation. Fred D. Rigby at the Office of Naval Research in Washington advised Tucker that the best route to take was for a university officer to ask the New York branch of the ONR to write to the Bluefield Draft Board. This process is said to work well. Normally, it takes place after the man is put in 1A, but there is no rule against its use in advance of that event. Rigby also noted that this kind of question is coming up frequently these days, suggesting that Nash was hardly alone among young academics with Defense Department affiliations seeking to avoid the draft. Rigby also promised that should the branch office action fail, we will then make a second try directly with the National Selective Service Organization, adding, however, that in all likelihood, this will not be necessary. The concerted effort to save Nash from the draft was not much different from similar efforts made for a great many other young scientists at the time. The Korean War did not inspire the same patriotic fervor as World War II. Many academics regarded defense research as a kind of alternative service, and the notion of exempting especially accomplished and valuable individuals had antecedents even in World War II. Kuhn remembers trying but failing to join the Navy's V-12 program, which would have allowed him to spend the war attending the same classes at Caltech that he would have attended as a civilian, only in uniform. He wound up in the infantry only because he failed the Navy's tougher physical. Korea did not prompt the massive draft evasion of the Vietnam era, de facto a working-class war. But among a certain elite in Nash's generation, there was a sense of entitlement and a lack of embarrassment about obtaining special treatment. The urgency of Nash's efforts to avoid the draft suggests deeper fears than those related to career ambitions or personal convenience. His was a personality for which regimentation, loss of autonomy, and close contact with strangers were not merely unpleasant, but highly threatening. With some justification, Nash would later blame the onset of his illness partly on the stress of teaching, a far milder form of regimentation than military life. His fear of being drafted remained acute long after the Korean War ended, and after he turned 26. The age cutoff for draft eligibility. It eventually reached delusional proportions and helped drive him to attempt to abandon his American citizenship and seek political asylum abroad. Interestingly, Nash's gut instinct has since been validated by schizophrenia researchers. None of the life events known to produce mental disorders such as depression or anxiety neurosis, combat, death of a loved one, divorce, loss of a job, have ever been convincingly implicated in the onset of schizophrenia. But several studies have since shown that basic military training during peacetime can precipitate schizophrenia in men with a hitherto unsuspected vulnerability to the illness. Although the study subjects were all carefully screened for mental illnesses, hospitalization rates for schizophrenia turned out to be abnormally high, especially for draftees. Rigby's prediction was soon borne out. A handwritten note, dated September 15th, from the files of Princeton's Dean of Faculty Douglas Brown, records a telephone call from Agnes Henry, the Mathematics Department Secretary, who informed the Dean's Secretary that John Nash had telephoned her, asking the Dean to write to the Office of Naval Research. A few days later, Nash filled out a university form, information needed in a national emergency, in which he stated that he was registered at Local Board 12 in Bluefield, that his current classification was 1A, and that he had a chance for 2A application pending. The form noted that Nash was engaged in Project 727, Tucker's ONR logistics grant. In response to the question, "Are you engaged in any other research work or consultation of possible national interest?" Nash responded yes, and listed consultant for RAND Corporation. A note, added perhaps by the head of Princeton's grants office, mentioned that Nash had spent 3 years or more on the theory of games and related fields. Wrote paper in this field when at Carnegie Tech as undergraduate. 2 years to get Ph.D. at Princeton. Dr. Rigby has already told New York to support. The university immediately wrote to ONR stating that this project is considered by the logistic branch of ONR, Washington, as a very important contribution to the present national emergency. Dr. Nash is a key member of our staff in this project and is one of the very few individuals in the country who have been trained in this field. The ONR followed on September 28th with a letter to the draft board saying that Nash was a key research assistant and this contract is an essential part of the Navy Department's research and development program and is in the interest of national safety. Rand protected Nash as well. Rand's former manager of security, Richard Best, recalls writing letters for Nash and another mathematician from Princeton, Mel Pizikoff, to save them from the draft. Pizikoff's recollection differs from Best's, however. He says he wanted to enlist, but that his superiors at Rand wouldn't let him. "We had a lot of reservists and a great many young people," said Best. In 1948, the average age was 28.35 years. The personnel office wasn't well equipped to handle the situation. "I wrote some form letters to the draft board for Nash," he recalled. Nash's lobbying campaign worked, though he was not immediately granted the desired 2A. By October 6th, the university informed Nash that, "You seem to be safe until June 30th. Apparently, the board had simply postponed the designation for active service until June 30, 1951. The university advised Nash, "I would suggest that we defer any further action until next spring, at which time we can again apply for a 2A classification and can consider an appeal if this should be rejected." But at least for now, he had prevented the military from wrecking his plans. More important, by protecting his personal freedom, Nash may have protected the integrity of his personality and won the ability to function well for longer than he might otherwise have. Chapter 15. A Beautiful Theorem. Princeton, 1950-51. Strange as it may now seem, the dissertation that would one day win Nash a Nobel wasn't highly regarded enough to assure him an offer from a top academic department. Game theory did not inspire much interest or respect among the mathematical elite, von Neumann's prestige notwithstanding. Indeed, Nash's mentors at Carnegie and Princeton were vaguely disappointed in him. They had expected the youngster, who had reproved theorems of Brouwer and Gauss, to tackle a really deep problem in an abstract field like topology. Even his biggest fan, Tucker, had concluded that while Nash could hold his own in pure mathematics, it was not his real strength. Having successfully sidestepped the threat of the draft, Nash now began working on a paper that he hoped would win him recognition as a pure mathematician. The problem concerned geometric objects called manifolds, which were of great interest to mathematicians at that time. Manifolds were a new way of looking at the world, so much so that even defining them sometimes tripped up eminent mathematicians. At Princeton, Salomon Bochner, one of the leading analysts of his day and a fine lecturer, used to walk into his graduate classes, start to give a definition of a manifold, get hopelessly bogged down, and finally give up, saying with an exasperated air before moving on, "Well, you all know what a manifold is." In one dimension, a manifold may be a straight line. In two dimensions, a plane, or the surface of a cube, a balloon, or a donut. The defining feature of a manifold is that, from the vantage point of any spot on such an object, the immediate vicinity looks like perfectly regular and normal Euclidean space. Think of yourself shrunk to the size of a pinpoint sitting on the surface of a donut. Look around you, and it seems that you're sitting on a flat disk. Go down one dimension and sit on a curve, and the stretch nearby looks like a straight line. Should you be perched on a three-dimensional manifold, however esoteric, your immediate neighborhood would look like the interior of a ball. In other words, how the object appears from afar may be quite different from the way it appears to your nearsighted eye. By 1950, topologists were having a field day with manifolds, redefining every object in sight topologically. The diversity and sheer number of manifolds is such that today, although all two-dimensional objects have been defined topologically, not all three- and four-dimensional objects, of which there is literally an infinite assortment, have been so precisely described. Manifolds turn up in a wide variety of physical problems, including some in cosmology, where they are often very hard to cope with. The notoriously difficult three-body problem proposed by King Oscar II of Sweden and Norway in 1885 for a mathematical competition in which Poincaré took part, which entails predicting the orbits of any three heavenly bodies, such as the Sun, Moon, and Earth, is one in which manifolds figure largely. Nash became fascinated with the subject of manifolds at Carnegie, but it is likely that his ideas did not crystallize until after he came to Princeton and began having regular conversations with Steenrod. In his Nobel autobiography, Nash says that right around the time that he got his equilibrium result for N-person games, that is, in the fall of 1949, he also made a nice discovery relating to manifolds and real algebraic varieties. This is the result that he had considered writing up as a dissertation after von Neumann's cool reaction to his ideas about equilibrium for games with many players.